Your Honor, I'm going to go a little bit out of order here and just briefly address the sufficiency assignment of error. Commonwealth has argued regarding the presumptions and the conclusions made by the jury in this case, especially with regards to our third assignment of error regarding the intent to commit robbery, which, of course, we can't know because whatever intent he had was frustrated by the complaining witness in this case, claiming that Mr. Parker did not challenge the jury conclusion of breaking and entering with intent to commit robbery. There is, of course, another instruction saying that an inference of intent to commit larceny would be is an instruction by in this case. But our position is all convictions have been appealed to this court, and therefore all issues are probably before this court.
Why would that be if you didn't assign error to the instruction? He didn't object to it or assign error. Why isn't that the law of the case?
Well, Your Honor, we have appealed the conviction on the basis of sufficiency of evidence. And, of course, the intent to commit robbery was brought up with regards to specific intent for the robbery conviction. This is an attempted case. But our position is all matters have been appealed to this court, and arguments can be raised at this time.
Well, do you have any authority for the proposition that a matter can be properly before this court if error is not assigned to it?
Well, Your Honor, we've assigned error to the conclusion, but again, solely on the robbery charge. But our position with all matters being appealed, without argument on saying that the jury has successfully concluded and that conclusion can't be disturbed, of course, which we're appealing right now, saying they found he intended to commit larceny, obviously we have assigned error claiming that they can't conclude it was him in the math, which is a different issue. But I ask the court to find that it's preserved. If the court has no other questions on the sufficiency issues, I'll be happy to go back to the first two issues. I'll begin with joinder, and obviously the changes in the statutes at this point do create basically what we could call a de facto presumption of joinder, and we'll go ahead and concede that the Commonwealth met its low burden initially to ask for joinder. Our position is that Mr. Parker then met his burden of actual prejudice and was therefore entitled to severance.
Counsel, where can you point to in the record where it shows that there was actual prejudice, though, that Mr. Parker suffered?
Well, it's all over my brief. I mean, it points out in particular, I'll find the pages for you, but we point out various things that came in, and looking at page 18 and 19, or actually going back to page 17 through 19 of the brief, pointing out all of the various things that came in that that would probably not have come in had there been separate trials. We acknowledge that it's a high burden to move for severance once the Commonwealth makes its case for joinder, and better chance of acquittal is certainly not grounds for severance. But as far as actual prejudice has been in established, I'd again point out these...
But the evidence that was coming in that wasn't specifically related to your client, the court gave instructions in terms of any statements that they were to be considered in reference to the person who made those statements. So what is your basis of indicating its actual prejudice? You've also got, like, the phone records. Why wouldn't that be relevant? Why would that be something that's prejudicial in terms of phone records for both individuals, placing both of them together and therefore refuting your client's alibi?
Well, Your Honor, and the law is clear that that there's going to be some evidence that comes in either way, and we've got to show it has to be more than just some evidence. There has to be actual prejudice, and I think the best place to look is the statements of Mr. Brown that came in. That's Davis versus Washington from the United States Supreme Court, which makes clear that testimonial statements from a non-testifying co-defendant create actual prejudice regardless of the curative instruction being given, and our position is that's what happened here. The Commonwealth has claimed that this issue is not properly preserved at trial. The objection made and the request for joinder did clearly say that it was based on statements coming in, and it did not get any more specific as far as whether...
Let me ask you about that. It looks to me like you pointed to seven specific instances where evidence came in that you allege should not have, or allege in your petition or in your brief should not have. But the last four of those, the cell phone numbers, the visible injuries, the employment application, and the blood in the car, I don't see mentioned either in the motion to sever, or I don't see any objection to their admissibility at trial. Did I miss something there?
Well, Your Honor, I'd submit a motion to sever made before trial and reiterate after trial, giving the trial court the opportunity to determine what effect it had and consider the evidence in this case. I would submit that motion made clear why severance was necessary.
But if you didn't point out to the judge, to the trial judge, that those specific items of evidence were prejudicial to your client and should not have been admitted, how can you now raise the issue that they are so prejudicial that they require reversal? It's a 5A18 issue, isn't it?
if the court wants to look at it that way, but our position is by raising the motion to sever, and then certainly the court has access to what's been specifically raised in that motion to sever, and so this is just what happened because severance wasn't granted, and the motion was reiterated at the end of trial, and obviously nothing specific was expounded on that, but our position is that by moving to sever, the issue was placed before the trial court.
Logically, that's the same thing as we move to strike the evidence, and therefore anything that might set aside the conviction is fair game on appeal. Don't you have to actually make a specific objection to give the trial court an opportunity to fix it? We object to the decision on joinder doesn't allow you to argue anything that you can possibly come up with later.
That's true, Your Honor, but we would submit that any motion, the motion submitted to the court saying that severance was requested, obviously is going to take into account certain things that were anticipated to come in, that in fact did come in with regards to the motion being renewed after the trial, that counsel clearly believed were not appropriate. This is just simply what happened as a result of the trial court's refusing to sever, and that's the position, is that the motion to sever should have been granted. It's just what happened after the fact. With regards to the Sixth Amendment claim, again, the motion to sever did clearly state that joinder would result in statements coming in, and even though it wasn't specified whether it was based on hearsay or based on the Sixth Amendment, our position is he did preserve the issue that...
But our case law is to the contrary. Our case law is that you don't preserve a Sixth Amendment claim by objecting to the hearsay nature of the testimony. How do we get around our existing case law?
Now, of course, Sixth Amendment and hearsay have now been established to be completely separate tiers.
Exactly.
So that's the point. But
so if you never say Sixth Amendment at trial, how can you raise Sixth Amendment on appeal?
Yeah, our position is that having raised the issue of statements coming in at trial does preserve the issue of statements for appeal.
Is there anything that I can include in an opinion to support that assertion? Any case? Any statute? Any rule of evidence?
Not in our possession, Your Honor,
thanks,
at this time. But we ask the court to find that the Sixth Amendment claim was preserved and that Davis versus Washington does establish everything else. The statements were clearly testimonial. Mr. Brown clearly did not testify. The Commonwealth also states in its brief that Mr. Brown's statements were not a confession. Of course, the law is a little clearer with a U.S. Supreme Court case is that if it's not a confession, then it's not prejudicial. It doesn't even fit under the standard. But we can see from the record and from examples pointed out in my brief that these statements were used to impeach Mr. Parker's out-of-court statements that are offered to the jury to suggest that he wasn't telling the truth, and therefore the jury's entitled to find him guilty because he didn't tell the truth. So our position joinder should not have been allowed. Mr. Parker did establish actual prejudice. Yes, the case was stronger against Mr. Brown. That's not grounds for actual prejudice. But because these statements did come in, they were used to impeach Mr. Parker's out-of-court statements, that he did suffer actual prejudice from joinder, and that joinder should have been, or severance should have been granted. I'll move on to the HIPAA objection. The Commonwealth made an argument regarding that being preserved as well, and I think the evidence of preservation is far stronger there, even if we read it as slanted against Mr. Parker as we can. Page 612 of the appendix, if I have that right, that's where the objection on HIPAA grounds was made, and clearly said this applies to Annie Penn as well. Then we look at page, I think, 617 or 618. That's where the Commonwealth is saying that he said, okay, you can let the records in, but the record clearly states that trial counsel said this is a different objection. And I don't want to object to the records coming in, but I just want these other documents out. They were redacted. But any proper reading of the record would confirm that trial counsel did not believe that this different objection covered the records and said there were no problem coming in, but I think the record is clear that the earlier objection based on HIPAA remained continuing throughout that presentation. So our position is the HIPAA objection is properly before this court. And again, it is an issue that appears to be a first impression to the court. And the Commonwealth has made a point that we do agree with, that the purpose of contemplated by HIPAA is that the records ought to be available for criminal prosecution cases as long as certain safeguards were followed. So
how
we haven't
followed in this case, though, because in fact the purpose for which the records were subpoenaed was what they were ended up used for at trial. So how is that a violation of the statute, assuming that it's in play, that the Commonwealth actually comes within the purview of the statute?
Our position is that the purpose for disclosure of the records is to help the Commonwealth in preparation of the case. The Commonwealth has any means, that, a number of means that are specified throughout the statute of obtaining these records, so it's clear the General Assembly meant for the Commonwealth to be able to obtain these records.
Well, what about the subpoena in reference to the custodian of the records, where there was the objection made by counsel for the appellant that indicated that they didn't want, or the objection actually said, look, these records are for the purpose of coming into evidence. Isn't that sort of notice that the appellant had of what the Commonwealth's intent was that was consistent with the purpose of the statute?
Well, Your Honor, even if we accept that the appellant had notice, the statute requires more than notice. And we would disagree respectfully that the contemplated purpose of the statute was just to obtain the medical records and then hand them straight to the trier of fact. The Commonwealth can obviously obtain them through all the means listed in the statute, and then they can...
Well, generally, when you subpoena something in a case, it is to assist you in the in pursuing that case, whether it's it just gives you something, a piece of information that you can use to form strategy, or it results in actual evidence. In fact, that's why you have them turn over their records, the deuces take them part of this. How is that just not the entire purpose of subpoenaing records is for use in the case, and they were used in the case?
Your Honor, the problem is they were disseminated further. And that's where I think we run into difficulty.
But they weren't disseminated outside the parameters of the case, were they?
They were still disseminated.
But for the purposes of trying the case in which they were subpoenaed.
But Your Honor, the statute clearly says, I mean, no person to whom health records are disclosed shall redisclose or otherwise reveal the health records of an individual beyond the purpose for which such disclosure was made without first obtaining the individual's specific authorization of such redisclosure.
So is it your position that a criminal defendant can preclude the admission into evidence of medical records by refusing to consent to their release?
I think that's what the statute says.
Well, that's we try to interpret statutes so they don't result in an absurd result, and that sounds pretty absurd to me.
With all due respect, Your Honor, I can't agree with the absurdity. It does say that, and I think we can conclude, the Commonwealth can obtain these records. They can use them to prepare their case. They can find out what witnesses they need to use. They can call witnesses and the like. But I would submit that the purpose of disclosure was
to
help in...
How would DUI blood draw ever come into evidence?
I believe the implied consent law would probably kick in at some point that one consents to having their blood or breath tested by operating a motor vehicle.
Right, but it's a medical record. According to you, a medical record can never come into evidence if the defendant objects. So the lab result is a medical record. It is drawn by a healthcare professional and run through a test. How does that ever come into evidence?
Your Honor, I guess we're talking about that. I'm into my rebuttal time here, but I would point out that the lab result is not a medical record. The medical purpose is to obtain the blood sample. It's then transmitted to the lab, and so I don't think there's a HIPAA provision extending to the lab. I submit that's what the difference is.
All right. You have a little time remaining.
All right. I can say
for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Chris Chandler for the Commonwealth. I'll begin with that first assignment of error on severance. Opposing counsel is essentially arguing that because the Commonwealth's case against the co-defendant was somewhat stronger than the case against him, that severance as a matter of law had to be granted. However, this Court's case law has said repeatedly that that is not the rule. Simply because the case against one co-defendant is stronger than against the other does not mean you have to grant severance in such a case. Otherwise, we would be required to grant severance in almost every case, except for the rare exception where the evidence is in equipoise. In this particular case, Parker argues that several pieces of evidence would have been admissible against him that were admissible against his co-defendant. He lists some of those at page 17 of his brief. However, as you go through each of those pieces of evidence, it is not clear how he would have been able to prevent that evidence from coming in against him even if he were tried by himself. Because by his own statements, Mr. Parker linked himself to Mr. Brown and linked himself to Mr. Brown's whereabouts at the time of the offense. He claimed, in speaking with investigators, that he was at a party in Reidsville with Mr. Brown when the shooting occurred, and that then the two of them were transported to the hospital together. When the evidence proved fairly conclusively that Mr. Brown was in the home and was shot by ammunition fired out of the victim's gun, and that Mr. Brown's blood turned up in a vehicle that the third co-defendant was known to drive. That conclusively linked Mr. Brown to the scene of the crime and also linked Mr. Parker to the scene of the crime because he himself, through his own statements, linked himself to Mr. Brown and Mr. Brown's whereabouts. Thus, that evidence against Mr. Brown would have been just as admissible if he were tried by himself as if he were tried jointly. On the issue of Mr. Brown's statements, the United States Supreme Court held in Bruton that when a co-defendant makes a confession that incriminates the co-defendant who did not make the confession, in those circumstances, a curative jury instruction or a cautionary instruction is not sufficient to cure any actual prejudice, and you do need severance in that context. However, in Bruton, United States Supreme Court recognized the fact that it is not unreasonable to conclude that in many cases, the jury can and will follow the trial judge's instructions to disregard such information. The court just went on to state that when you're talking about an actual confession that implicates the co-defendant, the court is going to assume that the jury cannot disregard that. In this case, we do not have a confession by the co-defendant. All we have is a story about what happened that lines up pretty closely with Mr. Parker's story. They both claimed to have been at this party in Reidsville and to have been caught in the crossfire at that party. Because that was not a confession incriminating Mr. Parker, the court's cautionary instructions in this context were sufficient to avoid any potential prejudice or any potential Sixth Amendment violation. For that reason, if the court were to reach the merits, despite the fact that there's no mention of the Sixth Amendment in the objection or the motion for severance, on the merits of this case, what the trial court did was perfectly appropriate and proper under United States Supreme Court case law and under this court's case law in Blackmun versus Commonwealth, which I also cited on my brief. And the second assignment of error as to medical records, as this court has pointed out, the argument from the other side is essentially that these records were disclosed for the purposes of investigating the crime and preparing for trial, but that for some reason using the records at trial would have gone beyond the scope of the reason for the disclosure of the medical records. I think it would be absurd to conclude that the General Assembly intended to limit the Commonwealth in such a way to create so many provisions by which these medical records could be obtained by subpoena, different types of subpoenas, by court orders, and yet to somehow conclude that they intended for those records not to be available at trial would be an absurd result that contradicts the legislative intent in balancing privacy rights on the one hand and the availability of these records for use at trial on the other hand. On the third assignment of error and specific intent to rob, as the court has noted, there was a jury instruction that was not objected to that allowed the fact finder, the jury in this case, to infer from the unauthorized presence of Mr. Parker in the victim's home his intent to commit larceny therein. That jury instruction was not objected to, and thus is the law of the case. And thus he cannot now argue that the jury was not entitled and not allowed as a matter of law to make such an inference because the court's instructions, which came without objection, allowed such an inference.
But the issue is attempted robbery.
Correct, Your Honor. So perhaps that inference doesn't get you completely all the way there. So it allows you, the jury, to infer that when Mr. Parker was in the home, he intended to commit larceny. He intended to steal something from those victims therein. However, a robbery just requires some sort of force or some sort of threat. In this case, they're all holding assault rifles. The third co-defendant is firing at the victims. Clearly, that's enough to get you from an intent to commit larceny to an intent to commit robbery from the circumstances here. In addition to that, in terms of the intent to commit robbery, we know as a matter of law, as the law of the case at this point, that he broke into that house with the intent to commit robbery inside because he was convicted of armed burglary. And while he did appeal his conviction for armed burglary in terms of the sufficiency of the evidence to establish his identity, he did not appeal the necessary factual finding that he broke into that home with the intent to commit robbery inside.
Captain, so, yes, Your Honor. Part of what you used to support that is the Neff case, but isn't that distinguishable from what we have here? Because the appellant actually did assert both as error, where in Neff, he didn't. Do you want to?
In terms of challenge, in terms yes. of the the notice of appeal in which convictions are being challenged. Yeah, so that is a distinction, but I would argue that in terms of the outcome, it's a distinction without a difference, because there is case law that holds, and I've cited in my brief, Robinson and MicroStrategy at page 26, footnote 17 of my brief, that holds when there are factual findings made below that are not challenged on appeal, that those factual findings, that are not assigned error to on appeal, those factual findings become binding. And here, based on the court's jury instructions as to what the jury had to find in order to convict Mr. Parker of armed burglary, the jury had to find that he broke into that home with the intent to commit robbery inside. Because there was no assignment of error as to that factual finding, that finding is binding and controls as to the other convictions as well. So I think the court is correct that the Robinson and MicroStrategy would be better cases than the Neff case, just because of that one distinction. But I do think that the principle and the logic of Neff still holds in this case nonetheless. So for that reason, as a matter of law, his specific intent to commit robbery when he broke into the home was established, and his intent to commit larceny therein was established by the jury instruction. And there was no evidence of a contrary intent. If there is evidence of contrary intent once he's inside the home, then that can rebut that presumption. In this particular case, there's no if they had intended to harm the victims, kill the victims, they had opportunity to do so, but left. The female victim was lying on the floor in a prone position, waiting to be shot in the back. And instead of doing so, fortunately, the defendants left. That's indicative of the fact that they did not break into the home intending to kill the victims and then leave without stealing anything. The fact finder could reasonably conclude that they wore masks intending to hide their identity because they planned on leaving living victims, and that thus they had different intent when they broke into that home. So all these circumstances plus the law of the case doctrine and that jury instruction lead to the conclusion that the specific intent to commit robbery was proven. And finally, the sufficiency of the evidence on the identity gets back to the point I made earlier that Mr. Parker linked himself to Mr. Brown and to Mr. Brown's whereabouts, and thus linked himself to the ammunition recovered from Mr. Brown's body, which linked Mr. Brown to the scene of the crime, also to the blood found in the car of Mr. Brown's blood found in Mr. Canavan's car. And finally, the phone records linked Mr. Parker to the scene of the crime near the victim's home at the time of the offense, and also disproved his alleged hypothesis of innocence that he was all the way down in Reidsville when that crime occurred. So for all of these reasons, the evidence was sufficient to prove his identity, to prove his specific intent to rob, and there were no trial court errors in this case. For these reasons, unless there are any further questions from the court, I'd ask the court to affirm and rest on my brief.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Eisner?
Now, just to make a couple of brief points here. First, there is some mention in the Commonwealth's argument about following instructions. The jury could follow instructions of the court. And again, it's been raised that a jury instruction is per se insufficient when a non-testifying statement comes in. And as Commonwealth points out, it's not a confession. This isn't a situation where he said, yeah, I did this crime, and here's how this other guy helped me.
Is it your position that a curative instruction in a situation like this, where any statement is made, is insufficient, that it can never be sufficient?
I don't think that's our position, Your Honor. I think it's been made more or less clear by the case law that it depends on the kind of statement, especially if it's an exculpatory type of statement. There wouldn't be a jury instruction needed, or a jury instruction be sufficient. But our position is these statements were used against Mr. Parker. They are not necessarily used as affirmative proof, but they are used to impeach statements that he had also given. And I'd submit that's entitled to the same standard. The other point that I wanted to address is the Commonwealth pointing out the way to read the HIPAA statute, to say it would be absurd to say there's so many provisions in the statute by which the Commonwealth can obtain these records. There's no provision in the statute saying, and here's when the Commonwealth can just hand them to the trier of fact. So our position is the General Assembly's intent is clear. They want to make sure the Commonwealth could obtain these records for preparing criminal cases, but if they wanted to make it clear that the Commonwealth could just pass them along willy-nilly, they would have put that in the statute as well. Our position is the statute does give the Commonwealth the authority to obtain the records, but because it's silent about passing right along to the trier of fact, that means the statute was not intended to allow that. Instead, the language about it shall not be further disseminated controls and that the record should not have been disclosed.
All right. Thank you very much. We will greet counsel.